we're back. Second hour of the Harry Brown Show. I'm your guest host tonight, Jim Babka. Harry was here to open the show, but tonight we're privileged to have a special guest, and I was involved in litigation, putting a plaintiff group together that took a case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, challenging the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. And Brad Smith tonight is my guest. He is a former FEC commissioner and the author of the book Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform, which I do recommend to you. Brad, one more term before we get into the meat of this whole thing, and that is the granddaddy of them all. It's the justifying term, the appearance of corruption. What in the wide world is the appearance of corruption? And why should a government be allowed to protect itself from the appearance of corruption?
Well, this is the problem, and this is the Achilles heel of Buckley. As I said, Buckley is in some ways a Supreme Court decision that protected free speech quite a bit, but not enough, and this is the Achilles heel. The appearance of corruption is really whatever you want it to be, isn't it? If people think government's corrupt, then I guess it appears corrupt, and if limiting campaign finance contributions and expenditures is therefore allowed, there we go. In fact, initially when the court talked about corruption in Buckley, they seemed to be talking about quid pro quo corruption. You know, I give you money and you vote a certain way. I give you a bribe, essentially. But over the years, they've gotten more and more into a mushy, well, you know, some people have more influence than others. People think government's kind of corrupt. They think maybe if somebody gets a, you know, $300 campaign contribution, that's going to determine how they vote. There's no evidence that that's really true, but they think that, so good enough. So it's become a very mushy phrase, and in that respect, then, it's very dangerous. You know, people should think about this. Do any of us want to live in a society in which nobody thinks government is corrupt, in which everybody is totally trusting of government? I don't think we do. And you won't find a democracy in the world that has lasted where that is the case. Even in the most trusting democracies like Japan, even in the best of times, public opinion polls routinely show that about 25 to 30% of the people do not trust government. And that's a healthy thing in a democracy, especially if you believe at all in limited government. The founders didn't trust government. The whole Constitution is talking about ways to check government power. You know, we need to realize first that there's always going to be some level of corruption. And that's the other thing the court has never defined. How much appearance of corruption is enough? The other thing, of course, is that the appearance of corruption is a manipulable standard. That is to say, to the extent that Common Cause and other groups go out and spend hundreds of millions of dollars that they get from the Pew Charitable Trust and so on, and create in people's minds the idea that everything's corrupt, they've created the very problem they then purport to solve with regulation. You know, what sense does that make? So the appearance of corruption is a very poor standard. It's the really is the sort of weakness that opens up the entire system to regulation and outright suppression of speech. And almost any member of Congress can justify supporting almost any regulation just by saying, well, he's fighting the appearance of corruption. You can't prove that it's not there, because there's always going to be some people who think government's corrupt. And it's something that we need to move the court away from, but I don't know how you do it.
Well, I've got a couple ideas for you, and I want to get to those in just a second. But the folks, I want to make sure you're clear on this. The appearance of corruption is not the same as corruption. We're not talking about bribes. And we're talking about, you know, a standard that, is, as Brad said, is all over the place. When you mix this together with the compelling state interest, then the government believes it has the right to take away your First Amendment rights and the right to dispose of your income, your time, your properties as you see fit. If you want to make a contribution to the candidate, it's money you earned. You should be able to give as much of that money as you want to a candidate.
You know, you mentioned, Jim, earlier that a lot of people don't appreciate the importance of this issue. I think that's right. Even a lot of people who at a gut level don't like the idea of government regulating just say, well, you know, I don't have a lot of money to give to candidates. I don't give money anyway, so I don't really care a whole lot if my contributions and expenditures are limited. But what people need to realize is that it's sort of like if you went to a baseball game and they raised the pitcher's mound by like 6 inches, and you had one team that was a hitting team and one team that was a pitching team. Raising the pitcher's mound by 6 inches would really advantage the pitching team. And yet almost nobody watching would even know. They couldn't even tell that the change had been made. And they might wonder why there are so many more strikeouts than usual, but they wouldn't really know why. That's what campaign finance is like. You're tinkering with the rules of the game. And I tell you that the folks who are tinkering in this, the folks who are leading this charge, do not have the interest of liberty at heart. They are making this change, and you see it in the writings. They say, well, the reason we can't pass a national health care plan, the reason we can't pass higher taxes, the reason we can't pass all these different things is because people are actually participating in politics and lobbying members of Congress to make them not pass these things. You know, and that's what they want to stop. That's what they want to get at. So it is a very important issue, and we do need to stand up and realize that it doesn't matter if we ourselves as individuals are making large contributions. Other people are working on our behalf, groups that we belong to, whether it's the National Rifle Association or the Libertarian Party or whatever it is, are working for freedom on our behalf, and these laws are aimed squarely at those groups.
They really are. It's like a target painted on them. And I you know what, Brad, I really want to make sure we make everybody understand this in a real concrete way that really, I'm sorry, just I'll be blunt about this. I want to kind of punch people in the face with this because, you know, they're out there laboring in various fields, and a lot of Harry's audience are Libertarian Party members. They remember fondly his campaigns for president, and they wonder why the Libertarian Party can't succeed. Well, there may be a host of reasons why the Libertarian Party can't succeed, but in my opinion, the biggest one of them all is that it's held back. Now, we just had I don't know if you're aware of this today, Eugene McCarthy died this afternoon.
I did not know that. I'm sorry to hear that.
And Eugene McCarthy was one of the plaintiffs in the Buckley versus Vallejo case. Now, I don't remember, maybe you were a little more familiar with the story than I am. I had some contact with him in 2000. I did not actually talk to him, but I've got an autographed book from him, and he agreed we were putting together a comprehensive assault at that point. The entire campaign finance system. We didn't, and we just didn't have the money to go do it. We ended up getting involved in this McCain-Feingold thing and taking just a very small sliver of it. He was willing to be a plaintiff once again. Eugene McCarthy was able to unseat, able to get a president who was running for re-election, was able to expose his Achilles heel on the Vietnam War, and that was Lyndon Johnson, and get him to drop out because of a good showing in the New Hampshire primary. And that good showing in the New Hampshire primary, according to Eugene McCarthy, came as a result of a handful of very big donors. Am I right about this?
Exactly right. The popular image of the campaign was a bunch of college kids trudging through the snow. What was behind those college kids was lots and lots of money. Stuart Mott, heir to the GM fortune, contributed tons. The Dreyfus family, prominent Wall Street brokers, contributed large sums of money. These people were making contributions of $500,000 or more, which today would be like contributing, you know, $3-4 million into this race in New Hampshire. And nowadays you cannot do that, and it's one of the things that has really hindered the ability of new parties and outsiders to get off the ground. You know, it's new ideas that need a big financial backer. Think about it like starting a business. Imagine if you were going to try to start a business, but no bank could loan you more than $2,000. You know, so you'd have to go around and try to get hundreds of banks to give you $2,000. You couldn't do it. The way you can start a business is if you can find just one banker who's willing to gamble on you, who thinks you've got a good idea, you can get into the game and you can give it a fair try. That's the situation that new parties are in, that the Libertarian Party or other small parties are in. They're trying to get into the game, and they can't do it because no bank can loan them enough money to get their business up and going, no matter how good an idea someone thinks it is.
And the analogy that I always use, I talk about candidates in this very situation. If you're an incumbent, it's very easy to, particularly if you're a committee chair, it's very easy to raise the number of donations. When the donation is limited, the game is naturally raising more of them, and that's not a real challenge for the incumbent who has the perks of office and the power and so forth. He's going to raise that money, but the challenger, on the other hand, is going to be in a position akin to filling a swimming pool with a teaspoon.
That's exactly right, and it's very tough for the challengers to just get going without the money coming in.
I will probably talk about Eugene McCarthy again before the show is over tonight. I think this guy was a very special man who exposed some things. 1-800-259-9231, or you can email us at comments@downsizedc.org.
If you produce computer storage media, you need GlideRite test heads. GlideRite is a major supplier of test heads to most media manufacturers in the U.S. and Asia. In addition, GlideRite produces glide heads, burnish heads, certifier heads, and thermal asperity heads, focusing on meeting your specific needs with short turnaround times and optimum quality, all at a competitive price. GlideRite's delivery performance is unmatched, whether quantities are large or small. GlideRite has manufacturing facilities in Milpitas, California, and Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam. Each site is equipped with state-of-the-art tooling and computerized equipment. GlideRite's services include research and development, new design and technology, and engineering support. Whether you need standard heads or customized solutions, GlideRite is your expert source. So when designing hard disks, always specify GlideRite.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
I'm sitting in for Harry Brown tonight. I'm your guest host, Jim Babka. Harry was here at the beginning of the show, but has dropped out as we are having this discussion about campaign finance reform. It's an issue that interests Harry because he ran for president as libertarian, but you know, he even admitted to me before we got on the air that he's had a hard time getting terribly excited about this, even though he understands it's important. And I think a lot of people are in that same position. You know, the phone hasn't really rung off the hook tonight, obviously. We'd love to have you call 1-800-259-9231, or you can email me at comments@downsizedc.org if you're a little bit shy. My guest tonight has been Brad Smith. He is the author of Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform. And I wish we could spend time really delving into this book because there's a lot of good material here. Because this issue is really important, particularly if you are a Libertarian Party member or you want to know why there aren't more principled challengers winning elections, why the incumbent re-election rate is so high. We've already discussed one reason, and that is that when contributions are limited, the game is raising more of them. And when you have to raise more of them, that's going to be a lot easier for the incumbent than it is going to be for the challenger. Now, the challenger, if he wants to win, Brad, he's got to do two things, as I understand it. Number one, he's got to force the incumbent to spend his money. The challenger has to spend a lot of money and force the incumbent to begin spending his money. The more money that the incumbent spends, the more likely he is to lose. And he has to engage in what a lot of people call negative campaigning. He has to go on the attack and expose the incumbent's record. Am I right about this?
Right. I mean, basically, you're not going to beat an incumbent unless he's been indicted or something like that. You're not going to beat an incumbent unless you run ads that are critical of him and explain why he should no longer hold office.
But can't the challenger just trust the media to get his message out for him?
Now, no, and you know that. you know, and of course, actually, that illustrates, again, the advantage incumbents have. They get the ribbon cut, you know, they can send out press releases, they've got the whole staff to do all that.
Government websites. Yeah. They don't have to quit their job when they run for re-election.
That's right, they're in a much stronger position. So it's very tough for a challenger to get traction, again, unless they're willing to run negative ads. Now, the other thing the research shows quite clearly on your other point is that challengers need to spend money. If you limit how much challengers can spend, they will lose. To run a good House race now, for example, the U.S. House, you need to spend about $800,000. If you're a challenger and you can spend $800,000, you've got a pretty good chance of winning. But if you spend much less than that, you're going to lose, and it doesn't matter how much the incumbent spends. What we see is that the incumbent spending doesn't matter all that much. It's whether the challenger can spend enough that people get to know him, know why he's running, know why he thinks the incumbent ought to be beat. And so why we see challenger, or why, you know, you mentioned incumbents are in trouble when they're spending a lot of money. Basically, what that means is they're running against a well-financed challenger who is forcing them to fight for the seat. And once that happens, you know, it's 50-50 whether the incumbent wins. But if the challenger doesn't have enough money to start, the incumbent's home free.
When Tom Foley was running as Speaker of the House for re-election in 1994 against George Nethercutt, he spent an inordinate amount of money. It was over $2 million, if I remember correctly. And if the more money he spent, the more his poll numbers went down. He eventually had to pull his own ads.
Right. But that was indicative of the fact that he was essentially fighting a battle he was losing and couldn't figure out what to do about it other than to spend money.
But there's this misconception, I believe, and I think the data once again bears this out, correct me if I'm wrong, that spending more money automatically means you're going to win.
No. The candidate who spends more money usually does win, but that's because most of the challengers aren't able to raise enough money even to get in the game. Again, once a challenger gets in the game, he's got about a 40% chance of winning, and getting in the game is a pretty easily determinable number. Again, for a U.S. House seat in most areas of the country, it's about $800,000 right now.
But, you know, if you have a Senate or a congressional candidate with a big war chest, he scares off some of the better potential challengers who might be able to raise better amounts of money, right?
The the problem is that these challengers can't raise money because nobody can give them money in the size that they need.
And then there's another problem that's closely related to this, and this is something that's really overlooked. When we were in the process of putting together our plaintiff group, we went to another entity, another group of people, who, you know, defend the Constitution, claim to understand the Constitution. They were with us 100% until we said that there shouldn't be any compelled government disclosure. In other words, your entity that you were working at, the FEC, should be closed. There should not be compelled reporting. We said that it should be treated as the same way as a secret ballot and for the same reasons, intimidation and so forth.
Well, I think a lot of people seem to be willing to kind of look the other way at disclosure on campaign finance. Sometimes it's just a political consideration. They say the only way we're going to get deregulation is to at least agree to disclosure. But my view, particularly after serving on the FEC, is in line with yours. I mean, why should the government, let's put it this way, I often ask student groups, I say, do you think that the government should require disclosure of campaign contributions, and they all raise their hands and say yes. And then I say, do you think the government should keep a database of citizen political activity? And they all raise their hands and say no. Well, that's what a disclosure base is. That's what a disclosure database is. It's a government-maintained database of people's political activity. And anybody can access it. So you go into a job interview, somebody can look at your political contributions. You go to take a fitness exam to pass the bar or a medical profession, get your license. Somebody can look at your political contributions. You're in a state where maybe there's union violence and you're taking anti-union positions. People can go in, look at your political contributions. And I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. As you say, you know, our votes are secret.
We were in a unique position when we were running Harry Brown for president. Harry Brown was not going to win, and we all knew that. But yet, because of the appearance of corruption rules, and I don't know how you corrupt Harry Brown. I have no idea how you corrupt a man who isn't going to win office. He has no favors to sell, nothing to give you. We were engaged in what was really the ultimate educational campaign. This was Civics 101. This was democracy. This was all the stuff we were taught was good about America, was what we were engaged in. But we were still under these very same requirements. And we thought that our campaign illustrated the absolute absurdity of this entire situation.
Well, it goes to an even bigger point. One of the things people don't realize is that a lot of the folks who are hammered by these laws are the truest, you know, grassroots participants. When I was at the FEC, we fined husbands for giving too much money to their wives. We fined sons for giving too much to their parents, parents for giving too much to their kids. You know, how are any of these people corrupting one another? And then you get folks, I remember one case we got shortly after I got on the FEC, a fellow named Mac Warren, exactly the kind of guy that ought to run for public office. He was a former U.S. military officer, left the military, established a successful small business, never held office other than one term on, like, the city council in this little town in Texas. He decides to run for Congress. He spends about $40,000, of which about $20,000 is his own money. And, of course, he loses, but he runs a pretty good campaign. During the course of the campaign, they sent out a mail piece, and it had the campaign name and address all over. In fact, they had a place where you could send back money to the campaign, so they really wanted to have their address on it so you knew where to send the money to, you know. But they forgot to put on the disclaimer required by 2 U.S.C. 441-DA2, the U.S. Code, and one of their opponents filed a complaint against them saying, well, they don't have this proper disclaimer on here saying who paid for this stuff. And, you know, we ended up fining the campaign, and the treasurer of the campaign gets fined. They're personally liable for this. There's not money in the campaign after you've lost. And this is very typical kind of scenario, that this does impact real people who want to participate in politics, and it really hits the grassroots campaigns, the small campaigns, like Harry Brown at a presidential level, or people like Matt Warren running for Congress.
Only in America, folks, and you thought you had First Amendment rights. We'll be right back.
This is Harry Brown. You know and I know that government doesn't work, that it doesn't deliver on its promises. But how do you persuade others of that? My book, Why Government Doesn't Work, was written for this purpose. It provides all the ammunition you could want to show others that government is never the answer to a social problem. The book shows why government programs never work out as intended, why government grows uncontrollably, why government doesn't work. The book provides principles, examples, one-liners, and solutions. Why Government Doesn't Work is now available for downloading at libertyfree.com for only $9.75. That's right, just $9.75 for Why Government Doesn't Work. You can read the book on your computer screen or print it out and read it from your easy chair. You can get Why Government Doesn't Work tonight at libertyfree.com.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
And we're back, bottom of the hour, second hour of the Harry Brown Show. I am your guest host tonight, Jim Babka, president of the Downsize DC Foundation and DownsizeDC.org, and I've been joined tonight by Brad Smith. Brad, we're going to race through this section here, but you also got into a little bit of a tangle here earlier this year while you were finishing your term at the Federal Election Commission. You exposed what was going on behind the scenes at that time involving Internet regulation. They're coming after the Internet, too, aren't they?
You bet. There's a definite desire to regulate the Internet. John McCain and Chris Shays and the usual crew have expressed that in no uncertain terms. Now, it's kind of interesting. Publicly, they try not to downplay it and not say anything because they know that it's a very unpopular position. But in court documents, they have ripped into the idea that the Internet should remain unregulated. They've made very clear and have fought very hard against any effort to guarantee that the Internet remains deregulated.
There's a bill in Congress right now to exempt the Internet from these laws, correct?
That's right. It's worth noting the FEC, in implementing the McCain-Feingold bill, had exempted most Internet activity. McCain and Feingold and Shays and Meehan sued the FEC in court and won a ruling from a court saying that was an improper interpretation of the law. The FEC had to regulate the Internet. Since then, several members of Congress, led by Jeb Hensarling, but also including Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate leader, have promoted a bill to statutorily exempt the Internet, and the McCain folks have fought that bill very hard, got a number of editorials out of the New York Times and the usual crowd there.
So well, that's folks, if you want to get your voice in on that one, we have that up at our homepage at downsizedc.org. Under the campaign name is Free the Internet. You can go there and you can speak out on that. You heard about the 60-day rule earlier about not being able to run issue ads. We've got something on that as well on our page, downsizedc.org. Very simple for you to lobby Congress. Brad, it seems to me that there's not a lot of people doing a lot about this issue on our side of the fence here. I, first of all, let me get you on the record. Do you believe the Federal Election Commission should be closed?
Ideally, yes.
And you know, you've got the Pew Charitable Trust, you've got Common Cause, and you've got all these, you know, the New York Times. They're all working together, kind of the axis of evil, if you will. Who's out there countering them?
Well, there are groups such as the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation from time to time have done some good work, but you know, it's not what they're devoted to. If a judicial nomination comes up or something like that, they have to go spend time on that. Groups like the Rifle Association, the Right to Life folks have been very hard fighters against campaign finance regulation.
They've done probably the best job.
They have. They've worked very hard. But again, none of these groups is at their issue. So one of the things that I've done since leaving the FEC, and we've just started it up, only just incorporated a couple weeks ago, we have a very generous seed grant from the Chicago Foundation, and they will match the first the next $250,000 that we raise, by the way. We've started this group called the Center for Competitive Politics. Don't even have our website up, but we'll be operating early next year. We have already participated in filing briefs in the Supreme Court on a couple of cases that are coming up now regarding campaign finance. So hopefully we'll be a permanent presence for the pro-freedom side, but really we need to get a lot more involvement. People need to realize, as I said earlier, that this is their issue. Too often people are sort of like, well, you know, we're concerned about workers' comp, or we're concerned about unions, or we're concerned about gun rights, or something like that, without realizing that the whole purpose of campaign finance regulations is often to keep you from achieving your goals in these other areas. That's what these folks want to do.
Okay, folks, that's the Center for Competitive Politics, and it's coming early next year. And, you know, because I've noticed that there's not really a whole lot of people even doing the research on this. I know John Watt's done a little bit. I know that Jim Miller has done a little bit. He wrote a book called Monopoly Politics. You know, our campaign in large part was based on three books. One was about Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, and the printers that were around him. Your book and Jim Miller's book, and Jim was an expert witness in our case. You know, we advanced an argument that every man is oppressed, that there is a distinct right. If you read the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, it says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, and then they have a conjunction in there that indicates a difference, or the freedom of the press. We were arguing that every man is oppressed. Why didn't our argument resonate with the majority of the court? We definitely made an impression on Thomas and Scalia and maybe even Kennedy. Why didn't it resonate with the entire court?
Well, I can't answer that directly. All I can say is I think the court itself, you know, people have gotten out of the habit, or we've gotten into the habit, I guess, of thinking of the press as something special. But as the plaintiffs with which you were working pointed out, and I totally agree, I mean, the press is not, you know, a bunch of guys who are members of the National Press Club or have press cards in their hat bands like some old 1930s movie. The press was intended to be everybody. You had a right to speak, and you had a right to publish your views through the press. And it's hard for me to figure out why newspapers and television stations, which are almost all now owned by major corporations, or they're at least owned by wealthy people.
And sometimes foreign-owned corporations.
Right. And why we should say, well, they're exempt from these laws. But if you and I and a bunch of your listeners all want to throw in $50 a piece and buy $700 worth of radio ads, we got to start filing reports with the Federal Election Commission. You know, it's ridiculous. I do think that the intention was that everybody is the press, and that's really in some respects what this internet battle is all about. Here is a way that everybody can be the press for very little money. Anybody can set up a website and communicate with people, run news stories, whatever they want to run, and the question is, are they going to get that same kind of exemption, or are we going to save that for people who have enough money to buy a TV station or a newspaper?
And that's really what it comes down to, folks. It really is a free press issue, and you do have the right, you should have the right to anonymity. And I think that's the way that this has to be fought. But there hasn't really been an institution to advance that. Hopefully the Center for Competitive Politics will be able to do that. Brad, I want to close up with a question that is totally off the beaten path for you. It has nothing to do with campaign finance reform, but DownsizeDC.org is advancing a bill. I'm the president of DownsizeDC.org that would require Congress to read the laws as passes. It's called the Read the Bills Act, and it requires an actual physical reading of the bill before they're allowed to pass it. The bill has to be posted on the Internet for 7 days before they're allowed to cast a final vote. How does that resonate with you? What does that sound? How does that sound to you?
Well, you know, I think it's a good idea. I certainly don't think anything bad can come of it. I think it's good to remind members of their obligations to the Constitution. So I think it's a good idea. But, you know, in the end, all of these things are small parts. The bigger thing is we've just got to win over more minds to the broader idea that freedom matters, that it's important to pay attention to the checks on government power. That's really where it's going to come from. If we have a bunch of congressmen who don't take the limits of their power seriously, we can make them read the bill as many times as we want. They're not going to care. You know, they're going to sit there and thumb through the latest edition of the Washington Post or something like that while it's being read. So I think it's a good idea because it serves that purpose of reminding folks that this matters, that this is important. It would stop some of these late night, you know, shoving through things that nobody's had a chance to read and opposition can't organize to it. But the battle in the long run that we're going to fight, as you know, and you've been fighting it, it's a bigger battle, and it's a battle that tells people freedom matters and freedom is beneficial and we're better off with freedom. And that's going to be a long, hard fight because our schools are bad, our universities are bad. We've got to work cut out for us.
Brad, I'm not very fond of most of the people who have gone to Washington because I think most of them participate in the system and make the problem worse. But I have repeatedly told people that you were doing a wonderful job. You were one of just a very, very small group of people that I think really upheld your oath of office. And I want to say on behalf of everyone listening to Harry Brown, thank you for doing that and thank you for being on the show tonight.
Well, Jim, thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
When we come back, I'll give you some closing comments about this interview, and we'll talk about Eugene McCarthy.
Hello, Ted Anderson here with Midas Resources. Lately, I've been hearing people tell me that gold is so low now that it would be a perfect time to buy. With over 20 years of personal experience in the gold business, I can tell you that opportunities like this can be counted on one hand. The truth is, very few people have the fortitude to actually act on a market like this. However, they have become the elite group, more than doubling their investment over moderate time span. In 1982, gold was trading in a range of $275 per ounce. By mid-1983, it was close to $500 an ounce. In 1986, gold collector coins had quadrupled. Don't procrastinate this opportunity away. All the bottom-line fundamentals still support a strong future for gold. Call 1-800-686-2237 for a free evaluation of your gold portfolio. You'll be glad you did. That's 1-800-686-2237. Again, 1-800-686-2237.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network.
Until the top of the hour, second to last segment of the Harry Brown Show. I'm your guest host, Jim Babka, president of the Downsize DC Foundation and DownsizeDC.org. Towards the end of the segment, we got three messages here, and I want to get into them real quick to kind of wrap up the segment with Brad. In fact, I was kind of disappointed that we didn't have any calls for him. This issue is extremely important to me. RealCampaignReform.org was the organization I ran that organized the Paul plaintiffs. We had Larry Pratt and Gun Owners of America with us. We had Michael Cloud and Carla Howell, who were running statewide in Massachusetts at the time. We had Citizens United, which is a Republican-leaning group involved. We had some anonymous plaintiffs that I don't know who they are because we wanted to make some points. But we were trying to argue that every man is a press, that you have free press rights. And basically the way this works, folks, is the government is saying that they are allowed to place a license on the press. This is totally outside of our common law tradition. I mean, we fought a war so that the king couldn't put a stamp on our paper. He couldn't shut our presses down. And we've given this right away somehow. And the institutional press, which often is foreign-owned, now has rights that you as an average American citizen don't have. And they're even coming now after the blogs and websites. And this is just terrible. And on top of that, this is the number one reason why challengers have a hard time winning. The golden rule of politics supposedly is that he who has the gold rules. Well, there's not a one-for-one correlation, and, you know, the person who has more money wins. But it's certainly going to happen if you only raise a few hundred or a few thousand dollars for your campaign. We were required in the Brown campaign, and by federal law, the campaigns are required to begin reporting any donor, and you have to keep a very bizarre accounting system to keep track of all this. You're responsible for keeping track of this. As soon as the cumulative donations exceed $200, you have to report that person's name and their occupation and their city and state, and that's on a public form that anybody on the web can go look up. Prospective employers can go look it up. And, in fact, if you have an interest before Congress, the heads of the various committees can look at it, too. Congressman Davis, who's the head of the House Republican Conference, told a group of large donors that they were going to look to see where their money was going. If at least 70% of it wasn't going to Republicans, they were going to be cut off from some access that they had. It's very wrong that this should happen. You should be allowed to take your money that you've earned by the sweat of your brow and spend it as you see fit, and that includes being able to support the candidates you believe in. And there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and Democrats because they're basically chasing the same dollars, which are the people who are scared that they're going to be regulated or are coming to Washington because they want some kind of favor. The principle of ideology money, there just isn't enough of it out there. But I can tell you there are people with enough money that if they could write large checks that they knew would make a difference, they'd write the checks. But right now, they've basically checked out. We heard from Jan in Fort Collins, Colorado, by email. Jan writes that the campaign finance restrictions are one of several factors that make it difficult for alternative parties to compete with the two major parties. Another crucial factor is the voting method we use, called plurality voting. And he goes on to explain that until we reform our voting system, we're not going to make any headway. This is going to be even harder to do, Jan, than fix the campaign finance system. You're talking about introducing something brand new that the American people have never dealt with before. But until Buckley versus Vallejo, we didn't have a campaign finance reporting regime. The FEC didn't exist. And we need to get back to that, and that's a very important first step. I support proportional representation. We could begin to make some serious headway if there were people willing to back Harry Brown the same way that Eugene McCarthy was willing to be backed. I think we could have gotten Harry Brown in the debates, and I'm not kidding you when I say that. Scott in California said that he was trying to explain public choice theory to the typical voter is virtually impossible, but I think I have found a way of telling voters why politicians act the way they do. And he says that being in the United States Congress is like having sex 5 times a day, 7 days a week, and what rational person is going to give the chance to have sex 5 times a day, 7 days a week? Where do I sign up? He wants to know how we can motivate well-spoken, freedom-loving individuals to take 4 or 6 years out of their lives and run a serious campaign. He served in elected office and found that it was a miserable experience for him, and he was very appreciative of Brad Smith serving. And good candidates don't want to run because they know they're going to get creamed. They know they're not going to be able to raise the dollars. They wait until usually the office is vacant. Clint from Tulsa, Oklahoma says all this news is depressing. If Mr. Smith feels all this activism taking place now and in the past is pointless, since his description of government being so large that the efforts of groups like Downsize DC is of no effect, what's the point of doing anything at all? Is there any hope? I don't think that's really what he was saying, Clint, and I think there is hope. You know, what he did say in his answer was that we need to get a larger group of people interested. Now, if you participate at DownsizeDC.org, you know about our lobbying mechanism. You know that it is magnetic and it attracts people. You know that it's sticky and that they leave their name and contact information with us, and we could begin contacting with them on a regular basis. And that because we're harnessing the Internet, it's viral. They can spread the news to their friends very quickly and easily. But what we really are attempting to do is not win right now these battles in Washington, because right now we're still small and we're losing most of them. That's okay. I'm fine with that. But what we are trying to do is build an army so big that it cannot be ignored. And that's what we're really after at Downsize DC. That's our number one goal. Has been from the beginning and will continue to be. All the things that we're doing at Downsize DC are tactics so that we can become the big army that they can't ignore. You know, politicians are merely opportunists looking for a parade that they can lead. And we're building that parade at DownsizeDC.org. I'll be back for a final segment. We'll talk about the Patriot Act and Eugene McCarthy. Several days after the Patriot Act was passed, a printed version was made available for Congress to read. Yes, I said several days after the Patriot Act was passed. But that's not unusual. Congress routinely passes bills that has little or no time to read. I'm Jim Babka with DownsizeDC.org, and I say it's time for a new American revolution with the slogan, No Legislation Without Representation. Congress cannot claim to be representing us when they don't know what's in the bills they pass. They shouldn't take the words of lobbyists. They shouldn't rely on unelected staff. And they shouldn't take orders from the party leadership because, after all, they're supposed to represent you. At DownsizeDC.org, you'll find a bill that should be the law of the land. It's called the Read the Bills Act. You can read it at our website, DownsizeDC.org. Better yet, you can use our simple system to tell your elected representatives to sponsor the Read the Bills Act. Write it down, DownsizeDC.org.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
Final segment of the Harry Brown Show. I have the Culture Repair Show. You can hear it on Sundays at 4 o'clock Central. Right here on the Genesis Communications Network, and I'm looking forward to being there tomorrow and hope you will join me. Again, GCNLive.com is the way you can listen to the Culture Repair Show Sundays at 4 o'clock. That is my show. As we were going to the break, we were talking about whether or not we should be depressed about the results and about how big Brad Smith was saying we need to get big. And I agree with him completely, and that's our goal at DownsizeDC.org. Let me just share with you, when we first started the DownsizeDC.org lobbying system, we had 11,600 people on our email list. And just in the last few hours, just in the last couple, last 48 hours, basically, we crossed 21,200 subscribers. We started off with no people registered to use our electronic lobbyist system. any moment now, literally, at any hour, we will cross 10,000 registered people. We have sent very near 200,000 messages to Congress, and more than 20,000 of those messages have been on the Patriot Act. Very important that you act now. The Patriot Act is in danger of falling apart, but the Senate's back in on Monday, and there's a lot of pressure to cut a deal. We want gridlock. We want the provisions to expire. The president has made it all out of press. That was on his radio address today. It was about the Patriot Act. You can go right now. The Lady Liberty is gagged right there on downsizedc.org. Click on that campaign, and you can send a message. We also are doing our Real ID Act Grudge Day. On the 10th of every month, we remember that the Senate capitulated and allowed the law that created a national ID card to pass, the Real ID Act. You can let Congress know you didn't forget at downsizedc.org. Well, sad news today, former Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy died. He was 89 years old. He died in his sleep at an assisted living home in Georgetown. Eugene McCarthy challenged President Lyndon Johnson for the 1968 Democratic nomination during the growing debate over the Vietnam War. The challenge led to Johnson's withdrawal from the race. His legion of volunteers were known as the Clean for Gene Kids, and they had to clean up because they were anti-war activists. And if they wanted to give a good reputation to the senator, they were going to have to clean up. They were going to have to make a good impression. They did, and McCarthy got 42% of the vote in the New Hampshire primary, embarrassed President Johnson, and Johnson decided to drop out of his own reelection race. We mentioned not only was he opposed to the war, but he was also opposed to the campaign finance laws, and he was one of the plaintiffs in the Buckley versus Vallejo case. And in an interview, he got an award in 2000 for having participated in this. And he said about that, he said, we had a few big contributors back then, and that's true of any liberal movement. In the American Revolution, they didn't get matching funds from George III. Eugene McCarthy was a great American who stood by his principles, someone I admired. I've got an autographed book by him and communicated with him once in 2000, and I'm sad to learn of his passing. We could really use a Eugene McCarthy in the Republican Party right now, someone who would stand up to George Bush, embarrass him enough to bring the boys home from Iraq, and the women too. Well, this has been the Harry Brown Show, and I've been privileged to sit in for Harry. And on behalf of Harry, who was here at the beginning of the show, I want to say thank you for listening to this. And Brad Smith, thank you for joining us. Tune in next weekend, and don't miss my Culture Repair Show tomorrow, 4 o'clock Central.